This is Carrot Shtick, the podcast that looks at healthcare through the unblinking lens of data, gathering industry experts, partners, and others for casual chats on serious topics. With your host, Carrot Health founder and CEO, Kurt Waltenbaugh.
What barriers to health might be in place for recent immigrants from Somalia? Language? Navigating an unfamiliar system? Health literacy? Food insecurity? Financial concerns? Social isolation, loneliness, mental health issues, yes, all of these and more. How do we address this background, removing those barriers, to put people on a path to better health? At its core, this is a story of culture, understanding the whole person and their unique individual stories. These are things our health system is just not designed to do. Come listen to my conversation with Mona Carloni and Mariam Mohammed, two remarkable people who created Intercultural Alliance, a unique program tailored to the health needs of Somali women, taught through community, through food, and through the unique experiences of each. Mariam has worked extensively in program analysis and evaluation for private and nonprofit services. She holds two master's degrees, one in statistics, and is a Somali immigrant herself. Mona comes out of the creative design and marketing world with a passion for wellness design and holistic health coaching. Come learn how they work together to improve health disparities in Somali communities, one person at a time. Mariam, Mona, thank you for joining me today. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your backgrounds and what you've been working on.
Hi there, Kurt. This is Mona. Yes, my name is Mona Antilla Carloni, and I've been working in the healthcare field, it feels like a long, long, long time in various capacities, but over 35 plus years doing this work. Of late, I have really moved my whole focus into how can we better serve our communities in their health and well-being in terms of avoiding such serious illnesses as heart disease, diabetes, obesity, mental illness. How do we address these issues in a different way? And so my world has all been sort of looking at how we can better address those issues in a non-medical way to support our communities so they can really come to the table as full and complete and whole and not be pulled down by their health, by any other issues that they may be dealing with. And so I've kind of let go of my earlier career in marketing and design communications and said, this is where my heart is in really making a difference in our communities. And how do we sort of bridge the gap so that our communities are really getting the attention they need to fulfill who they are on this planet? And it comes down to me as finding our health.
And Mariam, how did you and Mona meet?
Okay. And Mona and I met 2002. I moved from, let me backtrack. I came to Minnesota 2000. I was visiting my family who were refugees, came here as refugees in Altana. And at the time I was living in Dubai, moved from upstate New York to Dubai to be with my late husband who found a telecom company that was helping, I'm ethnic Somali, the Somali community to come together on business basis because they were fighting over clan basis. So I visited my family and my husband ended up to be the prime minister. And then I ended up being stuck in Altana. And 2 years I was there and I moved here to Shoreview, Minnesota, 2002. And I was asked by the Somali community to develop a Somali parent teacher association. And I asked around who can be a good grant writer. And Mona's husband was the man I met. And so this was 2002. And she happens to live North Oaks. I live in Shoreview. We have 5-6 minutes drive from each other. And I loved, you know, Mona from the start. I had health issues. I have Crohn's. And I will go to the emergency sometimes when I have issues. And Mona fixed that for me. And I loved how she fixed. And I introduced Mona then to my colleagues in Euchre. And so this is where we are today. I come from philanthropy background. That's how I met your beautiful wife. I used to be a program officer. But then when I left that job, I joined to be a consultant for Euchre. Since 2012, I was there. And I introduced Mona's program to Euchre. And so far, they have been funding it, I think, for the last 4 years. And here we are. That's how I met her.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me more about the program, the Intercultural Alliance. How did that come to be, and what does it do?
So Intercultural Alliance is really about bridging the gap between community health and the healthcare system. So that's kind of what it grew out of. But it really started with when Maryam and I started talking about these issues and how do we serve our communities better. I've been doing this work for a long time, not in the Somali community, but when Maryam and I and our friendship continued to grow, we realized how important it was to address those individuals that were falling through the cracks. So Intercultural Alliance was kind of came together and was founded on the basis of how do we address health and wellness in various areas. It was actually business, it was health, it was community. So those three building blocks. And our focus in our programming has been in the health area and how do we really empower and support our women in the Somali community. And again, this is only our first entry, you know, using this program with Somali women, but it's really a program that has got, it's adaptable to any culture. But what we learned is that there is this gap, and we can talk a little bit more about that in terms of the studies, and it's all out there. Mm-hmm. We just did the research, brought the studies and the information to the table and went, we need to address this and create a program that does address it.
And to add to what Mona said, as I became a consultant for UCARE, I joined a group that's called, now it's called Equity. It used to be a disparity group. And one of the key things, you know, as you know, you can have, you know, they have to have some quality rating. They have to have programs that they have to fulfill through the federal government as well as the state to kind of say, this is what we do it for them to be accredited. So one of the key things they were struggling with, they would send surveys out, and especially to different minority communities. And they said, we love UCARE. Everything is perfect. Everything is excellent. Then UCARE gets all this survey answered. But the reality is when they check their numbers in terms of how these communities are doing, it's always low. So they were struggling with that. And I'm the one who said, you know, knowing Mona and her program and knowing the research that's out there, I think there are couple of them that Mona can mention, that the MDH at the time, 2007, was putting out of disparity how serious it was. Can you mention those two?
Well, there was a study, Closing the Gap, Applying Global Lessons Towards Sustainable Community Health Models in the U.S. And it says the solution to this problem of that gap is the development of a care model capable of bridging the gap between clinical and community settings. You know, the light bulb went off for us realizing that it's not just about getting individuals to the doctor, which is hard enough. It's having people take responsibility for their health and empowering them to do that, inspiring them to do that for themselves and their families in a way that's culturally appropriate and sensitive and transfers information that gives them what they need to make the right decisions or better decisions about their own health. Mm-hmm. We learned that lack of access to culturally competent healthcare is one of the most significant barriers to reducing health disparities for minority populations. And this is actually from a study from Betancourt and Green from 2007. This is not a new issue. Failure to understand and manage sociocultural differences may have a significant health consequences for minority groups. So there's many, many studies, and actually I can always email that information to you because they're all there to support the work, which this is all based on, these studies and more.
And I shared those with UCARE. Actually, I shared those with Gita. I shared those with the committee that Greg is part of. And I think everybody was looking for solutions. And I came up with saying, you know, I have a friend who is really amazingly helping me with my Crohn's. I was very sick. I was taking medications. At the time I left the McKnight Foundation, I didn't have healthcare. I had copra for a year. And so I had to pay $1,700 for me to be to have insurance because Crohn's was a pre-existing condition. And so she came along and I you know, since 2012, and now I'm not on medications. And all I did was change the lifestyle with the help of Mona, the program she kind of put together. And so I told my story to UCARE and to the committee, and specifically to Gita, who's a dear friend of mine. And I said, Gita, let's think of this. And she really liked the idea. And so we didn't wait for them. You know, as you may know, you can introduce ideas and things, but it takes time for funders to really do it. So I have a good friend who at the time was a director of the George Family Foundation. And I called her and I said, you know, I have this idea. Can we try? And she gave us the seed money. And so we partnered with TBT. We actually started with my family. So just to make sure that I have sisters who are overweight, who are struggling with diabetes, struggling with, you know, low vitamin D, lack of sleep. And so I say to Mona, let's start with 10 women and, you know, my family and their daughters who are also married. And that's what we did. And we created this video that Mona mentioned to you the other time.
Yeah.
And it was an eye opening where my sister, who was pre-diabetic, now no longer takes medications. My sister, who had lack of vitamin, you know, she struggled with vitamin D, and I will go with her to the doctor and she will give all these high doses of vitamin D. And then Mona introduced her to all these, you know, ways to increase her vitamin D. And she went back and she said, what did you do? And so really we saw firsthand with my family. And finally, when I show some results to UCARE then said, let's adapt this program and start funding.
And I think it's important to understand it's not simply seeing, okay, Mariam, you're having an issue with Crohn's or your sister. It's about how. It's the how and it's the process. So instead of saying, okay, let's give you a whole lot of information on what happens with a pre-diabetic state and what you need to do and teaching about all of that, or you need to lose weight in order to do this, this, and this. Instead, we built relationships. There was a lot of trust over the time, and it wasn't about getting all the information in quickly. It was about developing relationships. And so the program is really built on around building trust as the foundation of it all. And so we come together, we have tea, we have dates and almonds, we share, you know, just our stories together. We take time in the learning. There is always learning, but it's through our discussion, stories, cooking together. And it's not just top down, you need to learn what diabetes is, but rather, how are you living your lives and how can we shift and add some things in that might shift how you're doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Tea drinking, for instance, yes. All the sugar. So there's ways where the culture really comes in. And we are very attentive to that. It's not just about here was what you need to do about Crohn's, but over time, building relationships.
Does that answer your question or you need more?
Yeah, no, I think you've hit on a really key component. And I'll just mention that UCARE is a health insurance company in Minnesota that deals with Medicaid and Medicare members and has serves a large segment of the Somali community, immigrants to Minnesota. And so what you've hit on, it sounds like, is a way to provide culturally sensitive training around lifestyle and behavior that also recognizes what we now call social determinants of health and the barriers that are preventing people from leading their healthiest lives. So maybe say a little bit more about what is the structure of that culture training? What does it look like when you get these women together?
Pre-COVID, we would have women come together in a community setting. Let's say a community room that had access to video and a kitchen. So we would come in early and we would create an environment that was beautiful. And this is important pieces, even though it may seem extraneous and not important. There would be flowers. There would be hot Somali tea. There would be dates and there would be almonds, and that we would put the almonds in the dates so it would cut the intensity of the sugar and the sweet So you'd have a little bit of protein and fiber. So here's where the lessons go in without anyone even knowing. There'd be fresh oranges or mandarins. There would be all the cooking was all set up in the back where the kitchen was beautifully, you know, all the vegetables and all the things that we would need to cook were all set up. So the women would come in, they'd sign in, and they'd start to talk and check in and get to know each other, get to know us in a beautiful environment and in a beautiful space. The first week was all intake and getting to know each other. The second week, come in and check in. How was your week? Tell us a little bit about what it was like and what your family was dealing with or anything. And so we would start to build these relationships. From there, we would have a theme every week or every time we met. If it was about water and the importance of water or sleep, or what about blood sugar and how sugar affects a person? We would have information there. We would be very visual. And I was mentioning to you earlier, Kurt, that I'm a person that likes to research and I like to hand out information. Miriam would just laugh at me and go, Mona. So no. We need to talk it through. We need to look at it. We need to hear stories. So the learning for the two of us and for me, you know, has been huge. And I've always looked at this action reflection learning model of let's just walk and do it. And then we'll learn and we'll get back together and we'll do it. We'll talk about what we learned and what needs to be different and we'll change it next time. So we've been doing a lot of that over the years, action reflection and learning. And so no handouts, lots of visuals. And when there's families, we have the children come up front. So we usually sit in somewhat of a circle and the children help with the visuals. So if it's holding up cards that have donuts on it and going, is this high glycemic or is this low glycemic? The kids are learning and going, okay, mom. And they're pointing to the picture and they know, but they're asking their parents, what is that? Is that sugar or, you know, going to affect your blood sugar or not? And so we involve the family. And then after we do some of that and not too much, we go into the kitchen and we start to chop and cook and talk.
All together.
All of us together. Laugh. You know, recipe. I'm looking at the recipe. No one else is because it's really about what it looks like. Okay. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Stir, put in the oven or cook on top of the stove and you're done. But that's the beauty of what we've learned is that it's the coming together. It's the laughing. It's building trust. It's watching how something is cooked and going, oh, so instead of all this rice, I can use quinoa. I could even use zucchini pasta. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? And how do I do that? Mm-hmm. And what are some substitutes for some of the things I love? That tea. Oh my gosh. I drink tea 4 times a day with 2 or 3 cup teaspoons of sugar. What can I do that I don't lose that? Because that's a very important part of my life.
Mona shows, you know, 1 spoon of sugar, how much she has sugar cubes. And she will show them and say, 6 cubes. They always, oh my God, this is how much sugar I take in 1 cup. And I have 5 cups during the day. So, you know, I don't want to interrupt what Mona is saying. I think the other thing that Mona kind of did not mention that is so important in the Somali community. Mona comes in. I come in with her. I recruit these ladies. And usually we recruit in a neighborhood so they don't have to drive. They come down from the high-rise building. And so they come down to the, usually we get the kitchen in the high-rise building. And so they don't have to travel, which helps. And she starts with chanting of the, you know, the Muslim faith.
Yes, that's
Quran.
Another really important part.
So they come in and they're looking this woman who's white American woman talking about their own faith and telling them what God says about health and what God and this, how did she learn this? How? So they will ask me questions. They don't understand. And they said, she's one of us. How in the world she can mention the Quran? And so that really kind of sets the whole tone immediately. And they see this woman knows what God. So if she is this American woman who's an infidel, and she tells me what God is supposed to tell me, I should take it. And so they really, that sets the whole tone of the whole program.
So the tone is one of honoring the wisdom that lies right there in that human being in front of us. We're honoring and we're being of service. So when that woman walks through the door, we hand her a cup of tea. We don't let her go to get her own tea. we hand her the tea and we hand her a little plate of dates and her mandarin orange or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's a shift in, you know, this is about you. What are your needs? What do you need? What are your questions? We're here to listen and share what can support you and your family and living healthier and better lives.
And so different than our traditional healthcare system. I mean, I think of, you know, the experiences that people in a traditional community would have are, I go to the doctor, I get a diagnosis of diabetes, the doctor gives me a pamphlet or maybe a link to a video, and it's all private and secretive, and I go home and I have to figure it out on my own. And what you've done is build a community and a whole different approach to understanding not only disease, but sensitivity to those barriers to health, like transportation. We're going to have the event in their building so that no one has to drive to the clinic, right? Bring food to the table so that we share and learn how to prepare food. And that just is a wonderful, wonderful story.
And a lot of the learning happens in every other moment than when we're in front.
They think of her as a doctor. So that's when they bring their medications.
Yeah. And it's like, no.
They bring their medications. They bring their issues to Mona. And many times Mona changed the program and really comes up with dishes based on what she learns from these ladies. She learns from their diseases and she says, okay, now if that's the case, let's cook something like this. And they will learn how to cook that, and that's what they will cook. And they say, we feel better. I don't have joint pain. I feel better. I'm off from, you know, the medications. The doctor is so surprised. He's asking me what happened. And it's all about listening. So these 8 days, we are mini doctors. they bring their medications and we will say to them, you have this medication is this, ask the doctor this. So they tell us, can you come with us to the doctor? Will you come, Mora? And will you help our doctor to see what I'm going through? Because there are things, the interpreter, the other thing, Kurt, you have to understand, we use interpreting agencies, and most of the interpreting people really are not savvy. They don't know very good English. They don't know the terminology. There's so many translations are lost in the middle. And so they say, you guys, will you come to my doctor? I don't trust my interpreter. Will you come with me? Because they tell them, they don't tell what I think I have. They tell something else. That's a huge issue in Minnesota. These interpreters are really just no small English, and the doctors cannot tell the difference. And they think these interpreters can know what they're doing. They can't. I can give you examples where I went to my mother, and the doctor will give her medications. And I say, Mom, why are you using this medication? Oh, the doctor, and her interpreter told the doctor something that my mom did not even say. And so I have to go with her and say, change this, or from now on, I will interpret, which they don't allow in the state. You have to sign a paper because I think at the state legislature passed something where family cannot interpret for a patient. And so we're really fixing sometimes issues that has been created by interpreters, between the interpreters and the doctors.
And it's also important to understand that we are really working hard to bridge between what we do and their primary care. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, primary care has become the ER. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to break that because of the cost issues in the healthcare system. It's not efficient in any way, shape, or form for them. So we are trying to be that interface, getting information and understanding, and then encouraging them to go to their doctor, to go to their primary care, whoever they're working with, to talk about these things. If they've got questions, it will help clarify what those questions are, help them write out the questions, and then go back to their doctor. So we're continually going, okay, now go to your healthcare professional. This is how you can do this. I have a thing called a healthcare preventative care checklist, and it has all the little, your annual checkup, your mammogram, have you seen your OBGYN for your pap smear? Have you done, what about well baby checks? And it has all these little boxes of these, just the things we normally would do, but many of these women aren't doing on a regular basis.
No.
So we're helping them get on a pathway to using the system more efficiently, understanding how to work in partnership with their doctors.
I love the concept of combining health literacy with cultural literacy to generate the trust. I mean, that's just an amazing component. You had some insights as to why Somali women use the emergency room that I thought were fascinating, that kind of came out of your programs.
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I will use my mom as an example, who used to use emergency, not anymore. So what happens, they feel when they go to the emergency, they get full attention, number one. They said, when I go to my primary care, I have this interpreter, the doctor comes in 10 minutes he leaves, and then I come back, nothing has been solved. I have the pain. We're coming from a culture where, you know, people go to a doctor and the doctor is supposed to fix what you have. That's so we're coming from that culture in Somalia. And so for my mom, she feels like I have this pain when I go to the doctor. Why do I have still the pain? What is going on? So for her, she says, oh, I'm sick. And sometimes it's nervousness of why her pain did not go away. It builds up. And so she goes to the emergency. I get a call from my sister saying, mom is at the emergency. I go to the emergency. I sit with her and we will be there a couple of hours. And, you know, they do x-rays. They do whatever the other things they do, all the machines, the heart rate. They also, they think if they can get that, that is something they are not getting from their primary care. So to them is I could get complete service. And so they get that. And the doctors who are there will tell them, go follow up with your primary care. They never do it. They wait. They feel good. It's all in their heads. You know, my mom is 86. She's never even takes any medication. She's very healthy. But everything is in her head. So she feels better because they didn't find anything after they x-rayed her from top to toe.
So there's a fear issue.
There's a fear.
Yeah.
And so she feels better for so while. She's happy. And then she starts having these doubts. And she, in her mind, does not want to go to a doctor because they cannot give her all these x-rays and all these things. They cannot look inside. And so that's the bottom line. And so what we do is we help them to understand the danger of that, the danger of not keeping up with your doctor, the danger of also being exposed to these machines very often, what they can cause. And the minute I explained to my mom that this can harm her, she stopped using emergency completely. She doesn't go to an emergency for the last few years. And Kurt, you will be surprised. She never needed it. It was all in their head because of the fear and lack of really saying what they want to the doctor. It's someone else you don't know who's an interpreter. She's not your cousin. She's not your daughter. Who's going to tell? And then she comes back and she says, they gave me the same thing. I'm still sick. So that's a vicious cycle. I have been talking to UCARE about this interpreting business. I know it's big, but it's not helpful. It's very costly, but it's not getting. We have to figure out a way that we give these ladies, 80, 90% of the Somali people who are interpreted are women. For them, it's job. They don't really, how do we find them jobs? How do we also create what we created in early childhood, that the job ladder? Where these women who go to interpret, if they have a passion, they can be a nurse in the future or an aide in the future. But this is to me, it's the we need to manage that services, the interpreting services. And I have no idea how that will happen. I even thought of Mary Zimmerman when she was the assistant commissioner. I even sat with her and say, listen, this is really creating more harm than help. And I did a focus group. I did a survey just for my own in the Somali community and in the Hmong community about interpreting. And you will be surprised, Kurt, with the findings that so many of the people they are interpreting do not trust them. So they come to us, and that's why they go to number one. I think that's the number one issue. They go to the emergency. The other thing they go to the emergency is loneliness, especially within seniors. They're lonely, and when they have their heart beats, instead of taking deep breath, instead of drinking water and walking, and the food they eat, of course, is terrible, they feel they're dying, and so they call 911. So that fear also and loneliness is also causing. And any group that Mona and I worked, we documented, that has been something amazing that you can like. Not most of them don't use emergency at all. Mm-hmm. We taught them how to take deep breaths. We taught them how to call someone else and have a chat. We teach them how to eat healthy food and go to the bathroom. And they all say, I don't use emergency anymore. I didn't know it was harming. These machines were harmful to me. And so we are reducing the usage of emergency within the cohorts we're working with, which is amazing.
And I think, you know, kind of going back to the broader theme, it's all about trust, right? If people don't trust the interpreter, if they don't trust the primary care doctor that they see for 6 minutes, they're not going to open up and share those stories in the way that they share with your group. And I think that some of those stories that you told me were amazing, and how those stories of health and trauma that led to health issues were never communicated to the physician.
Yeah, and I have them. If you want me to repeat, I have a list of them, and they told us they've never shared. You know, some of them we have to really beg them to tell, and they were all crying, and we were all crying with them when they were sharing these stories because it was the first time they have shared in a group. Forget about their doctor.
And this part of being able to share, this happens probably in the fourth to fifth week. So
yes,
those weeks before are the time of building friendship, so that these stories can then come out. And, you know, their ability to share the story, their ability to talk about their health and articulate is another very important part of what our program is addressing. How do we articulate? How do we give it health explanations that will make sense when I talk to my doctor? So they get a chance to do that here.
Yes,
now.
Yes.
It's the fifth week of an 8-module.
This woman, her name is MH. We don't like to use their names. We just say MH. She said, I was in, and these are her words in Somali, and we kind of put it down in English, in a broken English. It comes out as if you have to tell in a kind of, I didn't want to change the words. So it says, I was in Mogadishu with my family in a neighborhood called Bakara. And one day there was an explosion that rocked the neighborhood. Probably it was a war between two factions. We had to run away without looking back. We did not take anything with us. Unfortunately, I lost two of my kids, a boy and a girl, when we were running for our lives. I can't find them, and I don't know where they are even today. I am so sick all the time, and the doctors give me medications. But the main issue for me is the fact I'm a mourning mother who's missing her kids for the last 16 years. I wish I will know if they're dead or alive. Because one of my kids got severely sick, she said, of the kids that survived, the UN sponsored me to come to the United States. My daughter, who is here, loses consciousness several times a week. We think it was the trauma she experienced while we were running away. Actually, this program has been helpful to me because I talk about my issues and I get relief by talking about it. That's what she told us.
And this is the person who was also on heart medication.
Yes, she was the heart medication, and she didn't know why. And once we help her with her doctor, she's no longer taking any medications.
So there were no issues really with her heart. It was mental trauma, and her primary care physician had never heard any of this, so he was continuing to prescribe heart medication.
Yes, and she said, I was just a mourning mother. I was mourning for my children. So my heart was broken, she said. Yes. So this another woman, it's interesting here too. Her name was A. I was at Baladhawa. Baladhawa is a border town between Somalia and Kenya. She said, I had two children and my husband was with me. One day we heard thunder noise, which sounded like rain, but we realized it was not rain, but gunfire. I witnessed people near me as they were hit by gunfire. People were dying in back to the side in front of me. I fell on the ground and lost consciousness. They took me to the hospital near Mandera. While I was in the hospital, the gunfire continued and reached where I was. My neighbor was killed. We ran to a camp and it was not safe there either. I witnessed the killing of a little girl and fainted again. I finally came to Kenya camp, but had a hard time sleeping all my life. I saw a doctor here and he said, I have some pain in my heart as it beats abnormal. During my life here, even though I was relatively peace, I always see all the things that I have seen. My doctor advised me to talk about it as I'm doing now. I'm getting better by eating right with your program and seeing all of you makes me happy. Also, listening to other people who went through worse things than mine helps me. Mm-hmm. Can you believe it?
Very powerful. And the ability to connect a program ostensibly around food and health to actually this sort of mental and behavioral health sharing, right, to open up and to be able to share those stories is something that just doesn't happen in a traditional hospital or clinic setting.
Yeah, and many, I can tell you, over 80% or 90% of the Somalis who come here lost some people. So they are all traumatized. And what do? They come here, they have to go to the county, they have to find a job. We really treat them as normal people. they have to keep all that. And then what do they do? They're all in pain and they go to the doctor. And nobody really connects the dots of saying, these people need healing. You know, they need someone to listen to them. You know, I lost my sister and my brother-in-law in the war. And I was here and I was devastated. I was in America, but my sisters, one thing I realized when Somali people talk about death, they don't feel sad. You know, when they tell me these stories, people I knew died, I feel, oh my God. And they're all laughing. And I say, what's wrong with you? Why are you laughing? And they say, we get used to it. We see so many people died. It means nothing to us. So, you know, it's like the soldiers who go to war and then when they come back, you know, it's a trauma. All the community is in trauma. You know, and people, I don't think we talk about it. I think Victims and Torture is an organization that has been helpful to the Somali community at the beginning, but lack of funding, community does not get a space of relief where they can talk about their war and their wounds. And then how will they raise the mothers? How will they raise their children? They can't. All they know is they're a robot. Some mothers told us they're robots. They wake up, they do these things. It's not about them. And then they collapse. And when they collapse, they go to the emergency.
It's interesting that even with each other, they don't share these stories.
No.
So in some cases, and many of the cases, if the stories you shared were the first time that they shared their story like that in public with their friends, because they are all living in their own isolated worlds, which is doing their work, like you say, just getting up, taking care of their children, their husbands,
yeah,
and not thinking about themselves. So we're creating a space for the first time to say, take a deep breath, literally, mm-hmm, you know, when we work with breath, mm-hmm, let's say some prayers, mm-hmm, and some, let's meditate in on these themes. Maybe it's on faith or gratitude or resilience, mm-hmm, and take time. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that they don't often have. And so we're almost forcing that issue by creating a bubble, mm-hmm, that allows them to reflect, to breathe, and to take some moments for themselves, which you would think is, what's that? You know, is that so important? But it's extremely important in this context for healing.
Yeah, that's just an amazing approach to take a culturally sensitive way, combining different needs, but ultimately recognizing that there's this shared trauma, this post-traumatic stress, right, trauma that permeates the community, and that is an important barrier to consider in the healthcare system. And our healthcare system, quite honestly, just isn't set up to manage that.
And that's okay. How do we rectify and how do we fill that gap? If that's the case, and they're doing their jobs beautifully, how can we do our jobs just as well and help connect these two entities, mm-hmm, so that these community members aren't being left isolated and alone, suffering with their trauma, but addressing the trauma and helping them interface better with that community so that we can both do our jobs and that these women, mm-hmm, and these individuals are getting attended, mm-hmm, to. Mm-hmm.
very important work. I appreciate your sharing these stories, and I hope that our listeners who are dealing with different cultural communities of their own for patients and members are able to reach out to you and continue the conversation.
Absolutely. And this is designed, we're working within the Somali community, but as I said, the components are adaptable. You know, when we talk about the Quran in the Somali community, there are other communities that we would, address and use different meditations for. Whatever.
This can be used in any community. We have a lot of mainstream friends who love this program. Yeah. It's just UCARE funds only the Somali community now, because that's where, they have largest members of, I think Somalis mostly are UCARE members. And so that's why they're funding. But I think we want to use it, hopefully in the future, it's be replicable in any community.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing more about Intercultural Alliance, and look forward to catching up with you in the future.
Thank you so much, Kurt.